This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Madeline Jenner, coming to you from Sydney on Gadigal land. Welcome to This Week. When the Israeli military raided Gaza's largest hospital this week, the world was watching.
News just in, Israel's Defence Force says it's now carrying out a military operation inside the Al-Shifa Hospital.
The Al-Shifa Hospital was being used for both treatment and as a shelter by thousands of people. As Israel blockaded the complex, grim reports trickled out. Electricity, fuel and water ran out. Premature babies were pulled out of their incubators and laid out on stretchers. As the bodies piled up, doctors said they were forced to bury dozens of people in a mass grave.
Dead bodies which had been in the hospital for more than 5 days now, more than 120 dead bodies within the hospital area.
The Israeli Defence Forces have long argued that Hamas uses the area below Al-Shifa Hospital as a command centre and that it treats doctors and patients as human shields.
Human shields are a key pillar in Hamas's operations. I will be sharing evidence proving that Hamas systematically exploits hospitals as part of its war machine.
As it combed the hospital for evidence, the IDF released footage showing guns, grenades and flak jackets, which it said were found in a hospital building.
This kind of gear is a gear for a major fight. These are vests with explosives for terrorists to explode on forces.
Later, the IDF said it found an operational tunnel shaft and a booby-trapped vehicle on the grounds of the hospital. Hamas denies these allegations and neither side's claims can be independently verified. So what does Israel need to prove to justify its actions?
So a hospital can't be targeted as a hospital. So as long as it is being used as a hospital and only being used as a hospital, it's a civilian object. In fact, it's specially protected and cannot be targeted.
Ona Hathaway is a law professor at Yale University. She specialises in international humanitarian law and the rules of war.
If a hospital is being used for military purposes, then that changes a bit. Then it can become a legitimate military object. But that doesn't mean necessarily that it can be targeted. Then we move into the question of whether the principle of proportionality permits an attack on the hospital. So that basically means, you know, how many civilians are going to be harmed, what is going to be the effect on the hospital itself and its ability to function.
Before Israeli troops went into the hospital, they said they had evidence that it was being used as a control and command centre. The US made some similar comments.
The first war crime is being committed by Hamas by having their headquarters, their military, hidden under a hospital. And that's a fact. That's what's happened.
Israel has now also released some video of what they claim they found inside. What kind of proof is required?
Well, so in order to authorize an attack internally, presumably the Israeli military has a process for determining whether they find the intelligence believable and, you know, whether in fact they have enough information to be reasonably certain that in fact there is a military use for the hospital. But that won't be the end of it. Almost certainly there's an ongoing investigation in the International Criminal Court, which has made clear it has jurisdiction over the situation in Gaza. And it will independently evaluate the information. So it will look at what it knows and what it's able to discover through its investigation about the information that was available to Israel at the time it made the decision, and then determine whether the evidence was sufficient, that it was reasonable to conclude that, in fact, the hospital is being used for these military purposes. And then again, whether it met the principal proportionality. So that is whether there were so many civilians that were liable to be harmed in the process that the attack wouldn't be lawful, even if it is the case that the hospital is being used for military purposes.
This is not the first time we've seen a hospital
used in this way. It's happened in other conflicts. But how difficult is it, and how increasingly difficult is it for civilians if this continues to be a model used by groups where they can put a base potentially, allegedly, underneath or near a hospital? That just puts civilians and hospitals in an incredibly difficult position.
Yeah, it's really tragic. And I think you put it right. I mean, here it's especially so because reportedly the military use is underneath the hospital. So it's hard to know even to what extent those who are within the hospital even were fully aware of the military use being made underneath and therefore had some knowledge that they were at risk as a result of that. We're seeing increasingly, particularly non-state actors, using the rules against states by locating their military operations, you know, among civilians in civilian home, you know, civilian apartment buildings, in and underneath hospitals, mosques, churches, other specially protected objects, as a way of protecting them from attack, with the idea that, well, this military is going to find it unacceptable or impossible to target this object. And the truth is, it does create a real problem for the targeting state, because even if you know that the other side is doing that, it does not relieve you of your obligations. So even if you know that your opponent is using a hospital in this way, or using a civilian apartment building in this way, or using a church or a mosque in this way, it doesn't relieve you of the responsibility to treat the civilians who are going to be harmed and the civilian objects that will be destroyed as civilian objects and civilians. And therefore, it may be impossible for you to lawfully take those strikes. And it is true that these non-state actor groups like Hamas are using that to try and protect their forces from attack.
In a place like Gaza, which is so heavily populated and there's really nowhere potentially safe for people to get to, does everyone become a human shield of sorts just because there is no other option?
Well, it's very hard to see for Gazans how they can really get someplace safe. You know, you're hearing these reports all the time that people were told to evacuate the north, and many did. But a lot of the civilian deaths that we've seen reported are coming in the south. And that's because civilians, in most cases, probably unwittingly, were located above or near a location where the IDF identified Hamas forces or headquarters or other kinds of facilities. And so were struck. That was true of many of the people who are taking refuge, for instance, in UN schools and in the hospital grounds and the like. These are people who, you know, had traveled there in many cases to flee under the warnings that there were going to be attacks in northern Gaza. They fled to the south, and then they found themselves right back in that same situation. So it's very true that Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on earth. And as a result, it's very hard for civilians to leave, to be sure that they're in a place where they're not near Hamas forces. This is one of the real dangers of any kind of urban warfare, I will say. I mean, this has been a problem in the past. And in any instance of urban warfare, civilians are necessarily at greater risk. But it means then that there's greater obligation on the forces on both sides to do everything that they can to avoid putting civilians at risk.
But when the situation in Gaza is so dire and war crimes accusations have been made about both sides, does the legal position really help people on the ground at all?
Well, I mean, I think it helps in that you're hearing constant refrains that it is necessary to try to take steps to protect civilians. Unfortunately, that doesn't appear to have been fully abided by, certainly not by Hamas, which, as we've talked about, has intentionally been using civilians as protection for its own forces and putting them at risk intentionally, and in fact, provoking this attack from the outset. But of course, you know, the Israeli strikes have also killed now thousands of civilians. And, you know, that's a real tragedy. It's a tragedy of the war. And I do think that these calls to abide by international law are important. They are reminding everyone involved of the importance of providing access to food, adequate food, water, fuel, and other necessities for civilians on the ground, and to take every step possible to avoid civilian casualties, even when we're seeing that that is not being fully effective. I shudder to think what would happen if we sort of threw the rules entirely out the window.
Ona Hathaway, a law professor at Yale University. Immigration policy is often a political football, and this week was no exception. The issue dominated Parliament after more than 80 people were released from indefinite detention following a High Court decision that the policy was unlawful. Until now, non-Australians could be held indefinitely if they failed a so-called character test that's applied to foreigners seeking a visa, and they couldn't be deported. But after dozens of them were let out, the federal government rushed through legislation to keep tabs on them. Mark Kenny is a professor at the ANU's Australian Studies Institute.
Well, it was a week in which we saw immigration policy, refugee issues, these kinds of things, which are not really strengths for the Labor government, areas of vulnerability, generally speaking. At least they have been in a political sense, and we saw them storm back into mainstream politics in really some of the most spirited scenes we've seen in Parliament this year and probably this term.
Some of these people have committed disgusting crimes. Disgusting crimes. Some of them have hurt people who are still here in our country.
A competent minister would have dealt with this matter by way of legislation at the first available opportunity, and he would have rushed that legislation through this parliament so as to prevent the 83 from going out into the community with the significant potential of committing more offences against the Australian public.
So it wasn't the government's finest moment.
So let's talk firstly about this legislation that we've seen this week. What does this legislation do?
Well, the legislation effectively patches up what the High Court has unpicked, which was the government's ability to detain people indefinitely that it couldn't send offshore, couldn't repatriate to home countries for various reasons, but who had served sentences for crimes in the most part, and had served those sentences, at the end of which they would normally have parole or be released, but which the government decided on character grounds, consistent with the government's power in terms of visas, decided that they would be detained pending removal, at least pending theoretical removal, but in practical terms indefinitely, because there was nowhere to remove them from. And so what High Court's done is really throw that out the window and say the government doesn't have that power to do that, and ordered the release of these people. The amendments, therefore, patch that up to a degree. They don't allow the government to just simply re-detain them, because the court, as I say, has said it can't really do that, at least not indefinitely. But it brings in mandatory sentencing for breaches of visa conditions, and those visa conditions now contain ankle bracelets, mandatory ankle bracelets, we understand, for the people who've been released. There are curfews, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfews. There are limitations on the kind of work they can do and the kind of movements they can make travel-wise, nationally and internationally, and whether they can be working in conditions or in industries that might put them in regular contact with young people in some cases. So they're pretty restrictive conditions, and they've been applied as a result of an incendiary political argument that exploded in the House this week and which the government effectively rolled over to.
The Labor Party has been quite clear to say it wasn't happy about the High Court's decisions, but essentially its hands were tied, right? These people had to be released.
Yeah, that's right. The court said that the decision, a 20-year-old precedent that the government had been relying on, governments of both stripes had been relying on in order to have these people detained on the basis that they were not suitable for free movement in the community. That was the logic. that power has been overturned by the High Court. It's reinterpreted the law and said the government doesn't have that power. And it ordered the release of these 84 people. It didn't leave it as a matter of discretion or as something down the track.
I might make the point that we fought in the court to retain them in taxpayer-funded accommodation, in the immigration detention facilities. I hope the Shadow Minister isn't suggesting otherwise. Of course, as I said only a minute ago, our concern is to maintain community safety. A critical element of that, in some cases...
It ordered the immediate release of these people, and that, of course, came as something of a shock. I mean, it was a shock for, I think, everyone involved in the application before the High Court from one of the individuals detained, that the decision came at the end of the proceeding rather than the normal, you know, 3 months or so that it might take for a decision to be handed down. So you had this kind of summary outcome from the High Court case that caught everyone on the hop. But you didn't have the High Court's reasons for its decision, which we are yet to see. So the government found itself in this position where it thought, well, we don't know how to patch this up because we don't know what the High Court is going to, you know, say were its reasons for making the decision, for making the ruling, and we can only write new law, make new legislation, as it were, once we've seen those reasons. The opposition wasn't having any of that. So you had this kind of paralysis on the government side and thunderous political campaigning on the opposition side. And it was a pretty toxic mix. And the government realised it was in trouble quite quickly. And as I say, caved into that pressure quite quickly. And we saw these emergency changes passed in the last 2 days of the sitting week.
Now, the opposition says that still the government should go further. They say the government should have been aware that this was a possibility. And in fact, Peter Dutton has gone as far as saying if he was in charge, some of these people would be locked up again.
These are the worst of people, and they're not even Australian citizens. And that's why they shouldn't be out in the community.
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? I mean, I don't know whether that's a reasonable thing to say or not. I think he's got a reputation as a very hard man, and so I don't doubt that that's his intention. I note that Claire O'Neill, the Home Affairs Minister, has made very clear that that would be her preference as well. That certainly was the government's preference before it was ruled unlawful. And the opposition's amendments were adopted by the government. Those strict conditions I talked about a moment ago, they were adopted by the government. I think the opposition's wanting to take considerable credit for having forced the government into the changes that it made into the emergency action, to a change of course, really, from wanting to sit pat for a while. And I also think the opposition wants to continue taking a dividend from this by saying, we, of course, would fix it up properly. This is just the result of what we did when we only had a short amount of time. I think they had an hour or so to draw up their list of amendments. And so it's inevitable, really, that in the political frame, the opposition's wanting to take a dividend from this on an ongoing basis. And it has been an area where they have been seen to be tougher than the government, and they want to maintain their ascendancy there.
So where does this leave our borders policy? This decision only affects indefinite detention, but there's no one left in our offshore detention centres now either. Does this potentially change our border policy more generally?
It's hard to know at this stage. There are quite a few unknowns about it. Even the nature of these amendments, the actual fine detail of them in terms of the way they work is not completely clear. The government hasn't been very transparent or eager to talk about the details. We still don't know what the High Court's reasoning was, so we don't know how fundamental its objection to the government exercising what it might have said was a judicial power. But we also know that governments have very wide powers in relation to visas. So there's some divided opinion on whether these amendments that have just been made are safe. And I suppose, therefore, there's also going to be divided opinion on whether there are ramifications for the broader body of border protection policy and immigration law. But it's certainly going to remain an inflamed space politically for some time.
Mark Kenny, a professor at the ANU's Australian Studies Institute. He was the UK Prime Minister who called the Brexit referendum, only to quit the top job when the country voted to leave the European Union.
The British people have made a very clear decision to take a different path. And as such, I think the country requires fresh leadership to take it in this direction.
But this week, David Cameron re-entered British politics, parachuted into the role of Foreign Secretary. It was completely unexpected, and it followed a week of very messy politics in the UK. Controversial Home Secretary Suella Braverman was sacked by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. A day later, she sent a scathing letter to the PM, accusing him of being a weak and uncertain leader.
Well, what we've seen this week, I think, is just an exemplification of the fact that the governing Conservative Party is quite profoundly divided.
Anand Menon is the director of the think tank UK in a Changing Europe.
But what we've seen this week is, if you like, the cultural right of the party, epitomised by Suella Braverman, the former Home Secretary, essentially being sacked by Rishi Sunak and then writing a letter saying she would have resigned anyway, essentially. It's a very, very unmanageable coalition that Rishi Sunak has to deal with. And this week has just exemplified how unstable it is.
So you mentioned Suella Braverman. She's been one of the most controversial Home Secretaries in recent times. Why?
Well, partly because she has used language that many, if not most people, think shouldn't be used by a government minister. She's talked in really quite stark terms about homelessness being a lifestyle choice. She's called people who march in favour of a ceasefire hate marchers. And that has annoyed not only sort of people outside her party, but many people within her party, which is when support for her started to erode. She's always taken quite hardline positions on everything from a number of Brexit issues to particularly the issue of immigration into the United Kingdom, and has sort of set herself up in a curious way in opposition to the government of which she was part, which has meant problems for the Prime Minister.
So it obviously came to a head this week. Was there a particular issue that set it off?
In a sense, the particular issue that set it off was the fact that the Prime Minister sacked her. Now, the Prime Minister sacked her because of the comments about homelessness and also because of the language she'd used in an article in The Times about the marchers. What's been interesting about this is there was no formal exchange of letters. She was sacked by phone, so we didn't get to see what the Prime Minister said to her. But what she did afterwards was she wrote a lengthy and incredibly stroppy, for want of a better term, letter to the Prime Minister saying, "You have betrayed me on several fronts. We had an understanding. You've let me down. You're not really fit to be Prime Minister." In a sense, she sent a resignation letter having been sacked. The one thing I would say about that letter is, given the level of her dissatisfaction with the Prime Minister that she expressed, you've got to wonder why she hadn't resigned beforehand anyway.
I mean, the letter is particularly scathing. Do you see it as damaging for Rishi Sunak and his government more generally?
I mean, it's not great for a Prime Minister to get that sort of letter from one of his own former minister, absolutely. But the thing about Rishi Sunak is, I think the Conservative Party, in a sense, is doomed to stick with him till the next general election because they've changed leaders so many times in the last few years. So I think even those who aren't particularly happy with his leadership, and there are a good number of them amongst his parliamentary colleagues, realise that changing leader again might just start to look a little bit silly. So I think, you know, it is very hard to imagine him being removed before the election. And in fact, a lot of what is going on in the Conservative Party at the moment is people jostling to be his successor in the event that he loses the next election, which most people think he will.
And the other surprising thing we saw this week was David Cameron brought back into the parliament. How much of a shock was that?
I think an utter and complete shock, to be honest. I don't know anyone who'd predicted it. It's quite interesting. If you look at some of the clips of the TV and radio coverage of it, the reporters are just gobsmacked.
Car coming up, number 10, Downing Street, I should say. Not quite sure who this might be. That's the security detail just opening the door for...
David Cameron! I was not expecting that.
You know, they absolutely hadn't expected it. And there's this sort of, oh my word, David Cameron's getting out of that car and there's a reshuffle. It was a sort of cannot compute moment. I don't think, I mean, you know, from a government, we've got used to British governments becoming very, very leaky over the last 7 or 8 years, but this was kept absolutely secret from everyone rather effectively.
And it wasn't even like David Cameron has just been sitting on the backbench or anything. He is basically being put into the House of Lords so that he can take up this position, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, strictly speaking, you don't have to be in Parliament to be a minister. It's a convention that basically ministers need to be accountable. And yeah, what Rishi Sunak will do is put him in the House of Lords. That causes problems as well, because, you know, at a time when we're dealing with a war in Ukraine, a war in Gaza, and global instability, uncertainty about Chinese intentions, to have a foreign secretary who can't be directly held to account in the House of Commons by elected members of Parliament is slightly problematic. And it'll be interesting to see what ways are found to try and compensate for that. But yeah, under the rules of the system, he can be in the House of Lords. It's perfectly fine. And that is what's going to happen.
And what do you make of what he might be like as Foreign Secretary? He and Rishi Sunak never saw eye to eye on Brexit, for example. Will they be acting in unison now?
Well, I mean, there are layers to that, I think. I mean, first and foremost, you know, we had the Conservative Party conference back in October, and Rishi Sunak devoted his leader's speech to criticising a failed 30-year political consensus that hadn't delivered for the British people. And David Cameron was responsible for a significant chunk of that failed 30 years, according to Rishi Sunak. So on top of that, a number of decisions, specific decisions that the Prime Minister has taken, have been publicly criticised by David Cameron. Cancelling a major train line between London and the north of England, David Cameron took to Twitter and said he disagreed and this was a bad decision. It was short-sighted. So it's not as if they agree on lots of things across the board. I think for political analysts in this country, the interesting thing about David Cameron is he marks an attempt by Rishi Sunak to appeal to traditional Tory voters. Since Brexit, the Conservative Party has changed quite fundamentally in nature. And Boris Johnson in 2019 managed to win a number of seats traditionally held by the Labour Party. This has been interpreted by most people as a desire to go back to core conservatism. It is, if you like, a defensive conservative strategy to defend their traditional heartlands, even if that means losing some of those seats that Boris Johnson won for them back in 2019.
And what does it mean for the party more generally? Some have perhaps unkindly suggested that this might be rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. What's your view?
Well, I think, you know, as ever, politics is about events. We have, about a year until the next election, most people think. The election doesn't have to be held until January 2025. And a lot of stuff can happen before then. So I'm always reluctant to say an election is a foregone conclusion. If the economy recovers rapidly, if events conspire to make the Labour Party look weak or divided, anything can happen. At the moment, I would say that if you were a betting person, you would be very brave to put money on the Conservatives winning at the next election. But I wouldn't say that it's hopeless for them. So in that sense, Rishi Sunak is desperately trying to hang on. He's hoping that Cameron will help that strategy. And they've got to hope above all else, I think, and this is something over which David Cameron has no control because he's foreign secretary rather than holding a domestic brief. The key thing for the Conservatives is the hope that the economy can start performing a bit better within the next year.
Anand Menon, Director of UK in a Changing Europe. And that's the episode for this week. Subscribe by searching for the This Week podcast. It's produced by Laura Corrigan, Nell Whitehead, Sam Dunn, and me, Madeline Jenner. Catch you next week.